Campfire Tales 2, Snap Judgment, Storytelling with a Beat. Stay tuned. Here's the bad news. 90% of your life is spent wearing underwear. So why spend it in anything other than a pair of MeUndies? MeUndies.com fit perfectly, keep you cool, are made from modal, sustainably sourced from beechwood trees in Austria, because that's how they do. 2 times softer than cotton, and now they're offering 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/snap. Put them on, take them off. If you don't love them, your first pair is free. Again, 20% off your first order of the world's best underwear at MeUndies.com/snap. Okay, so there's a proper order to camping. First, you gotta pick a good spot, get your tent set up, help out all the clowns who don't know what's going on. Send everybody to go play down by the river, the lake, the stream, the pond.
No, Michael. Put the iPad away. Go get dirty.
Now it's time to start the fire. Kindling first. Take your time. I know everybody's hungry. Hamburgers, hot dogs, lemonade, a hot chocolate for the kids. The adults start drinking whatever it is they drink. Now, send everybody out searching for sticks.
Make sure they're long enough.
And finally, that fire is finding its rhythm. Put another log on for this next part. It happens every time. That last bite of marshmallow, that's when the sun goes down. Red and orange explode into the horizon. Finally, everybody kind of calms down, gathers round, starts looking at the fire. Still gotta wait, there's plenty of time. Nobody's going anywhere. So it's just a little bit darker. Then you start off like a little bit of history. All right, you know the first people. The first people to live in this area. They didn't believe in dying. They didn't believe in it. They just thought everyone at some point took a long sleep.
Uh-huh.
That's why they dressed their departed in bedclothes. They wrapped them in blankets just like they were tucking them in for the night. And they'd sing lullabies to them every single night because they wanted them to stay asleep. It was said that when one of them woke up, they'd wake up mean. And maybe, I don't know, maybe it's because people forgot to sing. They got too busy, moved away. Maybe that's why right here, right where we put down our tents, after the sun goes down, there's been reports of figures. Figures wrapped in white rags, wandering through this forest, and every single one before they grab you with their cold, cold hands. They demand that you sing them a song. Yep. Nighty-night. Well, today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we proudly present Campfire Tales 2. Amazing stories from our favorite campers. No, they were not happy campers. My name is Hide Under the Covers until Hope returns in the morning. I hope somebody's making pancakes because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, our first story is from Maria Saratora Gunter. Maria's a hardcore snapper and winner of our scary story contest, but as you may or may not know, in order to be a winner, you first have to journey through the darkness. Maria's story is performed right here by our own resident sorceress, Julia DeWitt.
My birthday is the day after Christmas, so I get twice as many presents as everyone else. But my favorites are always the one I get from my aunt. For years, she's bought me collectible dolls. And now, at the end of high school, my collection is massive. but I'm still excited to add another one. I hold and touch the box from my aunt leading up to my birthday. I want to open it early so badly. I'm normally really patient about gifts, but this package is different. It's calling to me. Finally, Christmas is over and my birthday arrives. I remove the wrapping, open the box, slowly peel back the protective foam, and there's this doll. My mother, sister, and father, puzzled by my reaction, all want to see this doll. I remove it from the box and place him on the table in front of us. It's a male figure with a broad chest, maybe 18 inches tall, wears gray satin pantaloons and a pink satin open-collared shirt. The exposed legs and arms are stark white, each leading to dark black hooves instead of feet and hands. The porcelain face is that of a horse, with blazing green eyes ringed in yellow with flecks of red. On top of his head is not a hat or a crown, but a glimmering, twisted horn of silver. It's a beastly unicorn prince. We look at it stunned, and it stares back at us. From every angle, it seems to be looking at us with that menacing glare. Finally, my mother breaks the silence. "Put it away, so we can have cake." I place it on a shelf across the room, and we proceed with the cake, and the festive mood is restored. And then, it's the mirror in the guest room. The mirror is mounted to the wall shared with the shelf on which the doll sits, and it's fallen off the wall. The mirror has simply broken to pieces. Not knowing what else to do, we clean up the mess and just go to bed. I take the doll with me to my room and put it on my dresser. That night, I wake up in the middle of the night. My bedroom has become so cold. It's late December, but this is Houston, Texas, so the temperatures at night rarely dip below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I step out of my room, and I'm surprised to find that on the other side of the door, the temperature is much warmer. So I grab my pillow and a blanket, and I go to sleep on the couch in the family room. I'm just about to drift off to sleep when I hear a noise coming from the kitchen. It's like the click-clack tapping of feet. Little feet. And lots of them. I convince myself maybe it's a bug outside or some water dripping from the tap, but it persists with an irregular pattern. Whatever's making this noise is just steps from me, which means that it can see me. I'm so frightened that I can't move, and I start to cry. My mom hears me, and she comes out to the living room. "Why are you crying? And what are you doing out here?" I tell her about the cold in my room and the sounds of little feet walking across the tiles in the kitchen. She clearly doesn't believe me, so she turns off the light and lies down next to me to prove I'm just imagining things. And immediately, the clattering starts again. She grips my arm, slowly turns on the light, and then she goes to the kitchen. Nothing's there. She stays up reading next to me the rest of the night with the lights on. The next day, my mother calls her sister to ask about the doll. All my aunt says is, "It called to me." It caught her eye, but she wasn't convinced it was the right gift for me. She went home that evening without a gift at all and had a dream about that doll. So she returned to the shop the next day to buy it for me. I decide that the doll has to go. I take it outside to our concrete slab of a patio to smash it. The first strike on the concrete, I brace for the flying shards of porcelain, but nothing happens. So I strike it again. Nothing. I'm sure a third time will do it, but then, still, nothing. Shocked, I turn its face towards me, and the red-rimmed eyes meet my own. And then I feel something come over me, but it isn't fear, more like an acceptance of the doll's evil. And then almost without thinking, I take it back into the house and leave it on the kitchen counter, just lying on its back with those wild eyes staring up at the ceiling. That night, the temperature of my bedroom is normal, but I'm still too scared to sleep. I only finally fall asleep when I take the nightlight from the bathroom and place it on the wall next to my bed. And then suddenly, I'm awake again. That noise, the click-clack tapping of the little feet are back. And I can hear it getting louder, closer, I pull the covers tight around me and repeat to myself, "It's just your imagination. It's just your imagination. It's just your imagination." And then I see the light. A light so bright it's blinding, and it's pouring into my room through the cracks around, above, and below my door. I try to turn the lamp on, but I can't move. I try to call out, but as wide as I open my mouth and as hard as I try to scream, only air escapes my lungs. No sound comes out at all. I'm paralyzed with terror when the door begins to shake loudly like someone's violently trying to get in. The light's getting brighter. I need to shield my eyes, but I'm too afraid to look away. And then, like a bolt of lightning, the shaking suddenly stops. At first, I still can't move, but then as the tension slowly recedes, I smell fire. My muscles relax, and I reach for the lamp. Cautiously, I creep out of my door and open it. Can see a warm glow from the family room. I call out, "Who's there?" My father's voice returns sternly, "You should be in bed." I approach him in the family room. He started a fire in the fireplace and is stoking it. He puts his arm around me. "You can go to sleep now," he says gently as he kisses my head. I peer into the fireplace and I see it. The last smoldering remains of the doll.
Thank you, Maria Sarator Gunter, for your story. And did you hear it, Snappers? Beware the Unicorn Prince. That piece is performed by Julia DeWitt. Now, you know the supernatural. It often takes blame for things outside our control. The whole "the devil made me do it" thing. And some of you might say, "Excuses, excuses. We make our own futures. We shape our own destinies." Maybe. Then again, maybe not.
This story takes place in Annandale, New Jersey. Ken lived next to a huge 10-acre farmstead, and one day he was driving past it in his car.
But I noticed that there was a lot of police activity going on. You know, I never wanted to infringe on them, but I went down to see if my neighbors needed help. They had fallen into foreclosure. And the house was being taken over by the sheriff's department. There was a standoff between the sheriff's department and the woman who is the wife of the owner.
Ken's neighbor was holding a shotgun and wouldn't leave her house.
And at that point, I said, "Please put your guns down. I don't want to get in the middle of a gun battle." And I was able to disarm Jane.
Ken convinced Jane to calm down and the sheriff to let Jane have the rest of the day to move out. The sheriff went around the property taking pictures for the bank. And in the meantime, Ken decided to help Jane move her most treasured possessions out of her home.
She started telling me, "Why couldn't he just leave us be? We're multimillionaires and we had everything going for us until we moved onto this property. And the ghost, John did it. I'm like, "What are you talking about?"
Ken thought she was blaming some non-existent being for her own failures. The place was creepy, but that's just because they'd taken such bad care of it. Ghosts aren't real.
In the library of this house, which is the original funerary room, and in the fireplace, a piece of forged metal on it, in German, it says, "Don't bother fighting death, because death will always win." And when I was asking the woman what she wanted in the house, I said, "I got a screwdriver, I'll take this off the..." And she screamed at me, "Don't you dare touch that. That is John's. General John Van Fleet. And nobody's allowed to ever take that off the mantle. He would be very upset." So I'm like, oh my gosh, this woman that I've known for all these years, that she was just absolutely a wacko.
Ken was sad to see his neighbors go until his wife started admiring the old house. Sure, it was falling apart, but it could be spruced up.
We wanted to have horses and cows, and we wanted a historic property. That was paramount.
They were huge history buffs, and the house certainly did have history. Ken did some research and found out that the first owner had been John Van Fleet in 1742. He'd been a general in the Revolutionary War and had lived there with his 10 children. Perfect. Ken called the bank to negotiate details of the foreclosure.
They said, well, it's on 10 acres. A builder can come and knock it down. I told them that a house was historic. And I said, well, do you know that the house is haunted? And with that, the phone dropped. And I hear one woman say to another woman, oh my gosh, go get the photos, go get the photos.
Remember those pictures that the sheriff had taken for the bank earlier?
She said, we have a picture of a girl floating in the middle of the air by the fireplace in one of the rooms.
Rumor had it, that was John's daughter, Abigail Van Fleet. Neighbors started whispering about stories of Abigail and John floating through the house. There was talk about a curse. So John and his wife decided they wanted to do some investigating. They looked up the history of the house and contacted three of its past owners. Every single one told them the same thing.
That the house was haunted. And this is the kicker. Every single person that has ever lived in this house for the past 10 generations has ended up in bankruptcy. Many of them have become divorced. Several people that have had cancer. The mother of the last owner, she died of mysterious circumstances.
Ken ignored all the signs. He moved into the house, confident that they would end the string of bad luck. Until one day, when he was painting a room with his son.
I see this black cloud, this apparition, and it traveled across the room from one side to the other. It almost looked like a swarm of gnats, and it went right into the wall and disappeared. My son, Kenny, runs in from the hallway, and that's where the cloud went into. And he said, this thing just came right through the wall. This black mass. That was an absolute, to me, validation. I was always skeptical, and that is what makes me believe to this very day.
After that, General John Van Fleet started playing with them all the time. Things went missing, a presence filled the room, and it became clear that Ken's family wasn't special. After all, death will always win.
My wife is absolutely, positively, as well as all my kids, convinced that this house does actually have a curse on it, a bad, bad energy. Every house that I've lived in has been wonderful. We've had a happy home existence. My wife and I have a very tight marriage. Everything has gone to hell in a handbag with this house. And then I came down with stage 4 throat cancer. We're heading towards foreclosure ourselves.
Ken's cancer also gave him short-term memory loss. He can't work, and now his wife holds down 2 jobs to sustain them. They fight a lot now.
And the only reason that we maintain a strong relationship is because we always keep in mind that there's something that's at hand here that we're beyond any control over.
Well, there's one thing they can do. Ken's looking for a new house, one with a little less history.
Thanks so much to Emil Klein for venturing into the haunted house to get this story. I would not do it, no way. We'll have a link to Emil's storytelling and art project, Your U.S., on our website, snapjudgment.org. The story is produced by Stephanie Fu and Emil Klein. Now, when Snap Judgment, the Campfire Tales 2 episode returns, it's not easy to scare a 5th-degree black belt and professional martial arts instructor snapper. It's not easy, but it can be done. Stay tuned. Evil lurks. Because it's out there, know this. Simply Safe Home Security is the smart way to protect your home or small business. 24/7 protection and emergency response. Simply Safe makes sure help is there when you need it most. So go ahead. Give the bad guys a bad day. Get your award-winning wireless alarm system from Simply Safe today and enjoy a special 10% off when you visit SimplySafeSnap.com. Right now. That's SimplySafeSnap.com. SimplySafeSnap.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Snap. Did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars? Well, you would if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. On Fresh Air, you'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Campfire Tales special. We're featuring some of our favorite stories for telling under a full moon. And you gotta know that people in our home base of Oakland, California, they hail from all over the world. And we've discovered that when you move in, you don't just settle with your family and your stuff. People bring their ghosts with them. Our next story is produced and lived by Stephanie Fu.
It's a dark and lonely road, somewhere around Santa Clara, California. My father's in his car, driving his friend Lee home from a dinner party. His friend Lee is quiet, staring out the window.
All of a sudden he said, "Don't look back. Don't look back now." Out of nowhere. And his eyes was big, big like lanterns. And I said, "Why not?" And he said, "There's a ghost in the back seat."
Now, hearing this would send shivers down anyone's spine. But my father has always been a rational man.
"Why did you tell me that the tooth fairy wasn't real when I was 4?
I thought as a 4-year-old you should know that all these things are inventions just to keep kids happy."
And at this point in his life, Lee was not the most reliable of sources. He was really going through a tough time.
"He lost his job. He's psychotic. What it means is he hears voices. He sees things that are not there. He's mentally unstable."
The things he saw and heard would usually come out late at night, around 2 a.m. He said the ghosts live in the chimney.
"He just said, 'I hear voices. I hear things. I hear knocking. Knocking.
Knocking.
Knocking.'"
My dad tried to convince him to see somebody, but Lee refused. And there just comes a point where your friends have to help themselves. But one day, on a business trip to China, he brings up his friend to some colleagues, and they mention
a seer.
What's a seer? Is it like a psychic?
I guess he's a psychic, a Buddhist priest.
He's a friend of a friend. And I said, "Hey, I don't want to pay money for a bunch of hocus pocus, right?" And my friend said, no, he doesn't charge at all. He won't take a penny. As a matter of fact, if he takes money, he will lose his power."
So my dad says, "What the hell? It's free. He's already in China. Let's just see how it goes." They meet in a restaurant. The seer is this totally normal guy. He's wearing a t-shirt. He's a construction worker. And he's completely uneducated.
He knows zero English. He knows nothing about the internet. I'm sure he doesn't. I'm not even sure he's very literate, this guy.
Which made his abilities all the more strange.
Actually, all I had to do was say, "Well, I have a problem with my friend." And he already basically started to talk like he knew what I was talking about. He says, "Yes, I see him. And I see what his problem is." He looked away for an instant. And then he says, "I see his house."
Asked him, "You don't even know where the house is." He says, "Oh, I know where the house is exactly." So he starts describing the house. "Okay, the house is bright in one spot, facing this direction. However, that doesn't prove anything, okay?"
But just as my dad is getting skeptical, the seer gets more and more specific. He goes through what the floors are made of, where the hot tub is, the color of the couch, the shape of the coffee table. And each time, he's right. And then he uses his hands to illustrate the limbs of a strange, gnarled tree in Lee's backyard.
"And when I went back to the house, I looked at the tree. My God, the directions the branches were pointing is exactly the way his arms moved. It's like a spiritual Google map." By then, my goose pimples are starting to grow in my arms. This is really eerie.
Then, the seer says that Lee wasn't even supposed to live in this house. He'd bought another house 10 years ago, but moved into this one instead
because his wife wanted to. My father had not known any of this.
And there is absolutely no reason why the CEO would know.
But later, he finds out...
It's true. The history is true. You can see across oceans and you can see it back in time.
Okay, so the guy can see stuff. Cool. But so what? What does this have to do with Lee's visions?
And this guy said there are two ghosts in this house who's bothering your friend. One of the ghosts he described was an old white woman who's all hunched over, and she hops around like a bird.
Hopping.
The other ghost he described was an old man, and the old white man had a big gash, a big bloody gash right across his chest, and they hang out right next to the chimney.
I asked him, how do you see things? He said, you know, as I talk to you now, someone over there is seeing for me.
The seer tells my dad that the ghost world is kind of like a bureaucracy. Areas in the world divided up like cities are ruled by deities who see everything that happens there. And they monitor the actions of ghosts. Ghosts are souls that don't have enough energy or chi to re-enter the cycle of reincarnation. So they loiter around the world like it's a 7-Eleven parking lot. But if a ghost claims that you did something to him horrible in a past life, or maybe if he just doesn't like you, he can submit a request to the deities to take revenge on you.
So I did ask him, okay, are there spirits around all the time? And he looked around, he was in the restaurant. He said, oh, over there next to the door, the two of them hanging around.
And I said, oh my God.
But the ghost can't get to you unless you're low on chi.
Okay, your energy level is like an immune system. If you're happy and if you're a strong person, no ghost can come anywhere near you.
But if you're depressed and low on energy?
Oh, you're in deep shit.
So I asked him, what can you do? What can we do to help him?
And the seer says that since he's thousands of miles away, he's afraid to send a spirit to chase off the ghosts because he doesn't want to get them even more angry. But there's a really easy solution. Lee should just make tea from leaves of a pomelo tree. In Chinese culture, pomelo leaves are supposed to ward off bad luck. There's only one problem.
I don't know, there are no pomelo trees in California.
So my dad's like, okay, I'll smuggle some in through customs.
And this seer says, no, you don't need to. There's a pomelo tree in the back of his house. I said, no, there are no pomelos in California. And he says, no. No, no, no. There is one. On the way back, I'm rethinking. Holy smoke. If there is a tree, really a pomelo tree, I wouldn't know what to think.
So he gets back and he goes to Lee's house. He doesn't tell him about the bloody gash and all that because Lee's already unstable and he doesn't want him to flip his lid. So he just sort of glosses over the seer's visit and says, so, what does it take for a guy to get some pomelo leaves around this joint? And Lee's wife says,
of course there's a pomelo tree. When I heard that, I almost freaked out. I mean, absolutely freaked out. How the heck do you explain that? I don't know how to explain that.
I'm not the whatever unreal being type of guy. In my own life, there's never been any evidence of ghosts.
Man, this is as close as to physical evidence than I can think of.
9 months go by, but Lee isn't getting any better. Since he doesn't really know the whole story about the creepy couple in his house, he's not drinking the pomelo tea. Late one night, he gets up and starts to pound on the walls of his house with a hammer while screaming the entire time. Lee is starting to go completely insane. They're desperate. So my father takes Lee to China with him to go see the seer in person. This time, the seer knows exactly what to do.
A ceremony.
You know, the Chinese burn gifts to the spirit. We burn a car.
You burned a car?
Well, no, a real car. A paper car. The 3D models. Very elaborate. So you burn all this stuff. Of course, lots of cash. Passport with a big American visa on it. Piles and piles of cash and the paper Mercedes Benz.
snitch, snitch, I'm a real big timer.
A Mercedes costs $10, the Volkswagen costs $8. So what the hell you buy? Make sure you get the best treasure chest full of cash.
And the seer dressed up to conduct the ceremony.
Oh man, he looked the part. He's got these Taoist robes, he's got a sword, he's got a Taoist hat, he's got a bell. Ding, 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 he went and chanted all these things for a full hour. At the end of it, they said, okay, as long as you live in this house, nothing great will happen to you. But for now, the ghost will not bother you anymore.
So now, he doesn't see ghosts anymore?
Not that I know of.
Have you seen him recently?
I saw him a few months ago. He doesn't have that panic look around him anymore. Well, you know, he didn't see things anymore.
Maybe I should go and try to see if there were really an old lady, an old man. Look up the history of what happened there.
Well, that's not a very good idea. First of all, you probably won't see anything. And if you did see something, you're totally screwed.
Why?
Because they might come home with you. Why would you want to screw around with things you absolutely have no understanding with? That's not a good idea.
How are they going to come home with me? In the back seat of a car?
They'll come home with you. Any way they can.
I was raised to be a rational person. But now, when I'm driving home late at night, I keep an eye on the back seat.
Now, the next story on our Campfire Tales episode comes from a guy you wouldn't want to mess with. His name is Mirko Buchvel. Just to give you a taste of why you wouldn't want to mess with him.
Came here with a British karate team for the World Games in 89, and I've been here since.
So, Mirko is a big dude. 6'2", 240 pounds, 5th degree black belt professional karate master. But his ex-girlfriend, Candy, she knows a secret.
For a guy who looked so tough, he was actually scared to go home at night.
The karate master's scared of his own home. It started with small things, noises, things falling mysteriously.
There'd be noise from the kitchen.
We would hear things in his kitchen just fall. And then all of a sudden he would go, "Do you hear that?" And I go, "Yeah, did you hear it?" So we came up with just excuse after excuse after excuse for everything that was going on. Large things started to go missing, and things so big that you couldn't misplace it.
Things like laptops, silverware, all of his cleaning supplies one day disappeared, and so did his MP3 player. His passport, his keys, his green card, all the wires in his car were disconnected one morning. Still, all this could be explained away until one day, Mirko noticed scratches on his walls and light bulbs and furniture.
It was like zigzag scratch marks. And they were on a lot of stuff. They're on my kitchen table, had these deep scratch marks in it. My motorcycle, which I still have, still has the scratch marks on. All the same, very kind of linear, like lightning strike type of scratch marks. That's when I started to feel like, well, this is kind of getting violent. And that's when I started to get a little afraid.
He had gotten so scared that he didn't want to be in the apartment by himself.
My biggest fear, though, was that it was a poltergeist. It wasn't something that was happening with the apartment. It was something that was happening with me.
And here's the thing with poltergeists. The more you fear them, the more they do to you. Things started getting completely out of control.
Sitting and watching TV, I had a tower rack with CDs on it, and watching the CDs just fall off the rack for no apparent reason in front of me. There was no way of me, it had to be something. So it, you know, made me question my whole kind of belief system in a way.
When things really physically started to move and fall and toss, and he started to get really paranoid, he had this obsession over the things that were going missing.
What I ended up doing out of sheer frustration was I would sleep with my keys and my wallet and my phone in a Ziploc bag. And I would literally go to sleep holding this bag.
Mirko, who considered himself very reasonable, was starting to act irrational, kind of crazy.
You know, I'm not the sort of person that even believes in any of that stuff. I believe in Darwinism, you know, science.
But his reality was being shaken. He had to try something. Candy suggested they start with a Buddhist temple.
And then we were told by the monk at the temple to go for this process of getting this dead chicken, chopping it up in the living room, take pieces of the chicken and put it around the apartment in different rooms. And I'm not religious, I'm atheist, so that's another kind of extreme thing for someone like me to do. That didn't work. Things were still happening. And the last thing I tried was taking this like big Chinese dagger. It was solid metal. I mean, it's a pretty hefty piece of metal. What I was told was to put that facing out towards the street, and that kind of wards off evil. All that happened with that thing was it got torn to pieces.
Then he found the sword on the floor and it had been snapped in half. And it was almost like whatever was there that came by and broke it was kind of mocking him for even putting one up.
You'd have to have some pretty decent strength. I mean, I probably couldn't have ripped that thing in half. And none of this stuff basically worked.
A few weeks later, I was sleeping over at his apartment and woke up in the middle of the night. I see this person passing, and I'm like, oh, there's somebody in the apartment. And it's walking towards the bed. It sits down in the chair right next to me. She was there just to watch us.
You know, somebody came in, walked around the bed, sat there watching us, or sat there watching me. I said to her, you know, should I be afraid? And her response was very monotone. It was like, well, that's up to you.
So Mirko did some serious thinking about fear. He realized his biggest fear was that this thing would haunt him for the rest of his life, forever.
At one point of this situation, when I started thinking about, well, is this something that's going to keep happening to me? It's a pretty tough thing to go through because, you know, you can't talk about it. You can't reason it out.
And the only one who understood was Candy. And she wasn't so freaked out because it was clear this thing was after Mirko.
The whole time I was an outsider looking in and, you know, I was trying to console him, and only Mirko and myself really can know the feelings that we felt while we were there and the certainty that came along with it.
And then one day, the spirit came for Candy in her own house.
I go downstairs to the kitchen and I see something moving from the corner of my eye, and it's a butcher knife. The handle, it's just rocking. None of the other knives were shaking, but the butcher knife handle was rocking. And I freak out. And that's when I realized that the haunted apartment, like, it wasn't about him anymore. At this point, it was about me.
Candy left Mirko and told him it was over between them. If the poltergeist wanted Mirko, she wanted to be as far away from Mirko as possible.
I told myself, that's it, never talking to him again. Like, I felt bad, like I abandoned him, but I wasn't going to talk to him again.
Mirko moved out of the apartment. Today, he refuses even to drive by it.
I feel really bad for whoever moved into that place. So many times I felt like writing a little note saying, you know, get out of this place.
He doesn't like going to apartments at all, of any kind. In fact, today, Mirko lives on a houseboat. That story is produced by Anna Sussman and Jamie DeWolf. What are you? Scared? Don't be scared. We're going to explain everything. When Snap Judgment, the campfire episode continues, stay tuned. You know you're going to snack. You know this, so when you do it right. Get snacks from Nature Box. Over 100 healthy, crave-worthy options delivered right to your door. Zero artificial flavors, colors, sweeteners, 0 grams trans fat, no high fructose corn syrup, and it tastes amazing. Back away from the potato chips, man. Instead, get some jalapeno white cheddar popcorn, some pistachio power clusters. You know it's time to stop clowning. Go to naturebox.com/snap right now and get a free trial of their favorite snacks. Free snacks delivered to your door. What are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/snap to start your free trial today.
Hey, thanks for listening to Snap Judgment. Be sure to check out Fresh Air with Terry Gross. On Fresh Air, you'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know, and discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Campfire Tales episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and right before the break, I promised you that we were going to explain everything. I lied, but it's not my fault. There is no explaining certain things. You see, everyone that I know has a ghost story that they keep in their family. Our next story is about an entire family itself from beyond the veil.
I'm Kathleen McConnell. I live in Louisville, Kentucky. I am a certified professional secretary. I have been the executive secretary for the presidents of three different corporations in my career.
In 1966, Kathleen McConnell would take the bus every day to one of her earliest secretary jobs at a bank in downtown Louisville. She would pass an old brick house.
The house just had a draw for me, and I could always see this little girl standing in the front window. She appeared to be 10, 11 years old. She would always hold her hand up to the window glass, and I would do the same thing. I thought she was waving at the bus, and I would just hold my hand up to the glass on the bus.
5 years later, Kathleen and her husband were looking to move, and they ended up buying that old brick house. They moved in with their four children, including their 8-month-old baby, Duncan.
Well, the first night was uneventful. But the second night, we'd gone to bed, a little after 1 o'clock, it was like thunder in the house. Boom, boom, boom. And that's just exactly the way it sounded. And I woke up instantly, but I'm thinking, did I dream that or did I hear that? And then it happened again. Boom, boom. My husband said, did you hear that? I said, well, of course I heard that. What do you think it is? And he said, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. So he slips out of bed, pulls his trousers on, and he gets a handgun that he keeps under the mattress. I think, well, it can't be burglars. Burglars try to keep quiet if they're going to break into a house. So I got out of bed, and I walked down the same hallway to the landing of the steps, and George is standing there, frozen in the spot, and just watching the front door entry. And the inner doors of the house were opening wide and banging against the wall and closing, and opening again and banging the walls and closing. You could see that the outer doors, they were double doors inside and out, but the outer doors were latched down, and then finally it quit. And George and I stood there, and then stoically we just walked back to the bedroom. Didn't say another word. Got into bed, and I lay awake all night, and he went right back to sleep. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to sleep tonight. Something's going on in this house. There's no explanation, but you know it's obvious. You know there's somebody else in your house that you can't see. I knew we'd moved in to a haunted house. The next day, I knew what I had to do, so I went from room to room, asking whoever was there not to hurt my family, not to hurt my children. If they didn't want us there, we wouldn't be there, but we had just sold everything we owned and bought this house. So if there was any way we could live together, we needed to do that. Had anybody seen me, I'd have been carried out with a butterfly net because I could see myself and the insanity of it.
Throughout the day, she tried to piece together what she knew of this puzzle. She thought of a conversation she'd had earlier with her husband.
That morning, when George came downstairs, he said, did you bring my shoes downstairs? And I said, well, no. And he said, well, I can't find my shoes. And he said, well, I'll wear something else this morning, but while you're picking up the house, see if you can find my shoes. So I said, okay. Well, as I sat there folding diapers, I knew I had yet to go down in the basement, into the cellar. It was a cellar. You had to go outside to get into it. I opened this big, heavy cellar door, and it did allow a little light into the room. It was just a big big dark room. It had one light bulb in the center with a chain on it, so I stepped on something squishy. I thought, oh, geez, it's an animal. There's an animal in this cellar. And so I pulled the chain down and looked to see what I had stepped on. And there was George's shoes. I mean, I jumped so fast, I think I missed all the steps and ran back into the kitchen, realizing then that whomever was in this house, it had to be children. Only children would play a prank like that, because that's a childish prank. They moved the shoes, took them to the cellar. So I sat there a little bit, and then I was elated, really. But that was the first, last, and only time I was ever scared in that house, was before I found out who and what was in it.
She ended up thinking it was most likely a group of kids. Sometimes she felt like there was a baby. Bottles would go missing, toy balls rolled around the floor. Other times she says it sounded more like a teenager playing basketball in the attic. And she was pretty sure that that girl she used to see in the window was one of these spirit children.
Well, I came to know that there were three children in the house. There was a baby. I never did know how old, but I knew it was a toddler. There was a little girl about 10 or 11, and there was a young boy about 13, 14. When you're a mother, and you're already mothering four children, and you realize there's another youngster in your house, it's kind of just instinctive that you're going to mother these other children. As the days went on, I would be scolding sometimes, and sometimes I would just be mother. I thought they would come and take me away if they saw me talking to someone that I really wasn't sure was there. The first Christmas we were in the house, I know how ridiculous this sounds, I did buy Christmas presents for these three children. I bought the little girl a makeup case, and I bought perfume that was called Heaven Scent. The baby, the little receiving blanket.
And she bought the one she thought was a boy, a Nerf basketball set, hoping the loud bouncing sound she heard in the attic would quiet down.
Because I thought if he's going to continue to play basketball, he doesn't need to make all that racket.
She brought the gifts, along with a little ceramic Christmas tree, up to the attic.
And so I asked them all to come around me, and I could feel the warmth. It was no longer cold. And I just kind of made in my mind that they had warmed up to me. And so the air was warm. And I gave each one of them their gift. And I set the little yellow blanket beside me, opened it up and flipped it out, and explained it, you know, Duncan has one like this. And as I sat there, I could see the yellow of the little receiving blanket crumple up. So I knew either the baby was crawling on the blanket, or the children were sitting on the blank. But either way, I talked to them and told them about the gifts and about how you play the Nerf basketball. I had one critic to tell me that my story was toothachingly sweet, and she did not believe for 1 minute that I bought Christmas gifts for these children. And I said, well, I didn't tell the story for your benefit.
And then there were times when she thought these spirit children were protecting her own baby.
One evening, I left Duncan in the bathtub in the upstairs bathroom while I walked down to the nursery to get Duncan's pajamas. While I'm coming back, this is a deep clawfoot tub, and the water was just pouring into the bathtub like maybe he held on to the faucets and he turned them on higher.
She says she sees both faucets on full steam, filling the tub higher and higher.
But by the time I got in there, Duncan is suspended. He is being held above the water. The water is still rushing into the bathtub. I instantly grabbed my baby, but he is suspended above this water. I knew one of the children was holding Duncan above the water. I went into the bedroom, laid Duncan on the bed, and started drying him off. And I'm still a nervous wreck. I'm shaking all over because I feared for my baby. I could see he would have drowned. And then all at once, the smell of Heaven Scent was around me. Heaven Scent is the perfume I gave the little girl. And all I could do was wrap him in a towel and thank them. I just, thank you, thank you, thank you. You saved my baby.
For the next 5 years, Kathleen acted like a mom to what she called her spirit children in the old brick house. And then Kathleen's mother got sick, and her mom lived out of town and alone.
I knew I needed to take care of my mother. I needed to be next to my mother. We had to move. We had to move. My mother was not well, and I had to have a talk with the children. I think it was the day before we were moving. I had gone up to tell them we had to leave. I always had the meeting place in the attic. I was very emotional, just really trying to get their acceptance and comfort them at the same time. And then just out of the blue, this Nerf ball comes and hits me square in the head. And it was like, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. I had to laugh because the Nerf ball just came flying through the attic and hit me square in the head. The morning we were going to, the actual last morning, I had gone through the house and explained everything. And as I did, I heard someone crying. I heard some soft sobs, just soft sobs. And it was like looking through water or looking through smoke. It was the first time that I actually saw these children. The little girl, she was a very pretty little girl. She had the baby on her hip. She had a white nightgown on, and the baby looked like the Gerber baby almost. Little chubby cheeks, and he had a bottle in his mouth, and little blonde hair. And the little boy was slender, a little over 5 feet. Looked like something out of a Charles Dickens novel, actually, because of the way he was dressed. It was good. It was just good that I was able to see all of them that one morning. People tend to think, if you have an experience like this, you're either a liar or you're a crackpot. I'm here to tell you, there's more in the world than what you can see. I know what happened in that house, and all I can say is, keep an open mind. Just keep an open mind. There's more in the world than what you can see.
Big thanks to Kathleen McConnell for sharing her story with the Snap. You can find a link to her blog, Don't Call Them Ghosts, on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story, it was produced by Anna Sussman with sound design by Renzo Gorio. You've been listening to Snap Judgment, Campfire Tales 2. And if you like scary stories, we'll have a link to all 5 Snap Spooked episodes from whence these stories came on our website, snapjudgment.org. Subscribe to the podcast to have your stories delivered each and every week. Snap is produced by myself and the most unhelpful group of camp counselors the world has ever known. Please say hello to Jason himself, the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Pat, the hitchhiker, Miss City Miller, Anna, the vampire Sussman, Julia, sees dead people to wit, Joe of the Damned Rosenberg, the slasher, Nancy Lopez, the black guy who gets killed at the beginning of every movie, Davey Kim, Renzo, the Undertaker Gorio, the undead, Eliza Smith, Anna Adlerstein, Leon Morimoto, Jasmine Aguilera is standing right behind you right now. Matt Ducat is not. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is no place to offer the goddess Isis a blood sacrifice of several farm animals, and I don't even know where we got the keys. My apologies again to the CPB. PRX for Public Radio Exchange, who rushed out of the mirror when we screamed Bloody Mary 3 times at midnight. What have we unleashed? PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago is hiding something wicked. I checked the staircase. The other one. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could lay the Uber producer, Mark Ristich, down on the floor right here with a bunch of people gathered around and whisper, light as a feather, hard as a board, light as a feather, hard as a board. And when you failed to move him even 1 inch, you'd still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR.